Hi, this is Kurt Anderson. I wanted to let you know that PRI has a new app for iPhone and Android. With it, you can listen to great public radio programs, including Studio 360, live or on demand. You can download the app for free right now. That's the PRI app for both iPhone and Android. Search PRI in the iTunes App Store or in the Google Android Market. You can also download the app for free from studio360.org. Just click on podcast. Today in Studio 360, she was a young blonde band leader on the 1930s jazz scene who was in every sense hot.
It started like a flame.
Shake that thing.
She's kind of hot.
Kind of hot? She's smoking.
But there was a lot that the fans didn't know.
Anna Ray knew how to cut a rug, which I think is so important in light of what you've discovered about her background.
The secrets of Anna Ray Hutton. And later,
I opened it up and started to read it, and my jaw dropped.
Modern secrets of the universe revealed in a 2,000-year-old poem.
This is the actual beating heart, something coming back across the huge gap of time and changing the course of the human spirit.
I'll talk with the author of The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by PBS, presenting a look at the law that turned America lawless. From Ken Burns, Prohibition, starting Sunday at 8, 7 Central on PBS.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today, John Wesley Harding performs right here in our studio.
Where the house is cold and empty, and the garden's overgrown, where the letters lie unopened by a disconnected phone.
But first, did you hear the big 2012 election news this week?
Чтобы съезд поддержал кандидатуру председателя партии Владимира Путина на должность президента страны.
I'm talking about the Russian elections. That's President Dmitry Medvedev announcing that Vladimir Putin would be United Russia's presidential candidate for the 2012 elections. Putin is all but assured of victory, and he could potentially remain in power until 2024. Of course, Russian artists have seen this coming for a while. Anna Nemtsova is the Moscow correspondent for Newsweek, and she has been closely following how the creative class has been protesting Russia's ruling regime.
You know, we have a beautiful movement, underground movement of street artists all across Russia. It started a few years ago from a group called Vina, St. Petersburg artists, who declared a war, an art war, to corruption, to state corruption, to injustice, and more or less political regime. It was quite amazing what this group of artists were doing.
Well, what are examples of some of the things, some of the best things they did?
I don't know if you call it best, but I would say one of the most daring projects was this 60-foot-long phallus that they painted all over a bridge, Litani Bridge in St. Petersburg. And when the bridge opened to let the boats pass, this big penis was erected right opposite the headquarters of federal security.
The former KGB.
The former KGB, that's right. And nobody could do anything because the bridge was open and it was too late to bring it down. So this giant penis was sticking out for a few hours, and lots of people took pictures of that and loaded it on the internet. So now most of the leaders of Vina Group are wanted by police. They're on the federal list. They're wanted. So they're in deep underground.
As you say, the leaders of Vina are underground and they're wanted for hooliganism. How seriously apprehended have they been, and have their art projects been by the government? Has it been somewhat allowed, or they've gotten away with it?
They've gotten away for a while. Thing is, they even got the prize, you know, the best prize for modern art for the penis that I described.
They got a prize from the government Ministry of Culture.
From the government.
Yeah.
From the government, from the Ministry of Culture. That's right. It's a very interesting phenomenon we have in Russia. There are different corners of political power. One hand is giving the prize, the other hand is punishing. And here's what is happening now. To pull Vina and artists like them out of the underground and bring them, you know, to light and make them official and some sort of pro-state, Moscow authorities decided to put them on the list of participants for Modern Art Biennale that takes place in Moscow this week. And that happened against Vina's will, because Vina does not, they do not want to participate in official art events.
It's so interesting that on the one hand, that they are doing these outrageous regime-challenging acts. Part of the regime is attempting to co-opt them by making them part of this Biennale, and they're refusing to be co-opted.
You know, it is interesting, but they are in deep underground. You need to understand that most of these artists, I could not meet with Vina. Mm-hmm. I was only able to correspond with them by email. And another group that I'm talking about in my story is called Monologue TV. They're famous for their billboards that they put out in the middle of the night time all around Moscow. And as you can imagine, all the billboards disappear within the first few hours of the morning.
I saw an image of one billboard of Medvedev as Captain America holding an iPad. Is that Captain Russia?
Uh-huh. Captain Russia. It's also very, you know, very delicate irony here.
Right.
One needs to be deeply into the story that we have here to understand what this humor is about. Maybe we did want President Medvedev to be the superhero at some point.
Right.
The ideas he expressed never resulted as any, you know, serious act or reform.
Right. He lost his superpowers.
That was mocking his hearing.
Right, right. Are people beyond the art world talking about them? Is it having an impact among regular Russians?
No, I think that the sense of humor that artists have is obviously inspiring, especially young people.
Uh-huh.
They try to express their protest in different ways, mostly mocking Medvedev and Putin, prime minister. And that was long before the news we have now. But the artists kind of predicted, you know,
right,
predicted that humiliating act of two leaders deciding for people what they're going to do with Russia's future. They predicted that would happen. And they want to be free. They don't want to be told what to do, whether to participate in some state events or not. They want to be independent and decide for themselves.
Anna Nemtsova, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anna Nemtsova is the Moscow correspondent for Newsweek. You can see and read more about Russian protest art at studio360.org. And an update on a story we talked about last week. The Museum of Children's Art in Oakland announced that they are now trying to reschedule the canceled exhibit of Palestinian kids' art. We heard from lots of you about my conversation with one of the exhibit's opponents, and you can continue that conversation at studio360.org. The great science news recently has been the discovery of that planet with two suns. Two suns, just like Tatooine, Luke Skywalker's home planet in Star Wars. And so NASA, without missing a beat, nicknamed the new planet, you guessed it, Tatooine. Art has a funny way of anticipating discoveries about the nature of the universe. One of the most profound examples of this is an epic poem written more than 2,000 years ago by a Roman named Lucretius. It's called On the Nature of Things, and it presents all kinds of radical new philosophical and scientific ideas a millennium or two before their time. But then the poem was lost, and then found, and then lost and found again in a story that stretches across many, many centuries. That is the subject of Harvard professor Stephen Greenblatt's new book, The Swerve: How the World Became Modern. It is one of the most interesting books I've read in a long time.
The poem is very beautiful. It begins with a passionate, remarkable hymn to the goddess Venus, a hymn that inspired Botticelli's Primavera and other wonderful Renaissance works of art. At its core, it has a set of philosophical ideas. And the very central idea is about physics. And the idea from physics is this, that the world consists of tiny, indestructible, eternal, indivisible particles, which the Greeks called atoms. This Roman poet called them the seeds of things. And it consists of an infinite number of these atoms and nothing else, the void. The atoms are constantly in movement. They were never created and they'll never die.
In other words, they got it right early.
By our lights, they got it right, astonishingly right. And it's not just that they got that right, but Lucretius and the philosophers that he's following began to try to work out the implications of this strange and powerful idea, starting with the fact a universe that's made up out of atoms and emptiness forever has no designer or creator. It was done entirely naturally over untold billions and trillions of years. Now, we start from that.
So the story, as you tell it, really takes off with your account of this 15th century book hunter called
Poggio Bracciolini.
Who's this guy who pokes around old monasteries in the early 15th century around Europe looking for important ancient texts. Who was this guy?
He was a bureaucrat working most of his career for a succession of popes in the Vatican, and worked his way up largely for a strange reason, because he had magnificently beautiful handwriting.
Yeah.
But he always had this other slightly weird thing in him, which was the desire to find ancient books.
Which was a particularly interesting thing for a guy who works for the Pope to be doing, since these ancient books had been, for at that point, suppressed by the Christian Church for 1,000 or more years.
The church had a rather complicated love-hate relationship to the heritage of pagan antiquity. Many, in fact, most of the great early church founders were steeped in ancient pagan learning and literature. And what they felt was that they wanted to hold on to what was beautiful and powerful in that literature, but also destroy what was unacceptable.
And one of those unacceptable ideas in the poem is that the great human desire that drives everything is the maximization of human pleasure and the minimization of human pain.
It certainly doesn't sound like such a strange idea to us. They observed, as we would observe, that all creatures, including humans, go toward pleasure and away from pain. But what was unusual for them is that they said that this was the highest good, that everything about the structure of life had to begin and end with this desire to enhance pleasure and to diminish pain. And Lucretius actually thought a lot about sex because, after all, it doesn't take a genius to understand that there's a relationship between sex and pleasure.
They understood that even in 50 BC, I guess.
Even in 50 BC. But he also was troubled by these thoughts of sex because he understood, and this was also grasped in 50 BC, that there's a relationship between sex and pain. And that poses a problem for someone of his thinking. How is it, if he is opposing pain and pleasure, that the highest form of human pleasure, at least as many people feel, is also oddly associated with pain? Even in the hour of possession, he writes, the passion of the lovers fluctuates and wanders in uncertainty. They cannot decide what to enjoy first with their eyes and hands. They tightly squeeze the object of their desire and cause bodily pain, often driving their teeth into one another's lips and crushing mouth against mouth. And then he goes in closer to try to actually see the lovers in the moment of their ecstasy. And this is a translation done of these lines by the great 17th century English poet John Dryden. When the youthful pair more closely join, when hands in hands they lock and thighs they twine, just in the raging foam of full desire, when both press on, both murmur, both expire, they grip, they squeeze, their humid tongues they dart, as each would force their way to the other's heart, in vain. They only cruise about the coast, for bodies cannot pierce, nor be in bodies lost. As sure they strive to be, when both engage in that tumultuous momentary rage, so tangled in the nets of love they lie, till man dissolves in that excess of joy.
That's Stephen Greenblatt reading from Lucretius's poem On the Nature of Things from 2,000 years ago. So once this was rediscovered, how did its effects and its view ripple through the wider world over the next several hundred years?
In the immediate moment, there was scarcely a ripple at all. And once it did begin to circulate, it was very hard to figure out what it was, really, because in the case of this poem, a poem which said that the soul was made up out of atoms as well as the body, and therefore the soul must die with the body. There is no afterlife, no rewards, no punishment. With this poem, people scratched their heads and wondered what this was, what it was saying. And the people who actually got what it was saying became alarmed. And it's only really after 100 years, after 200 years, that you begin to see it pressing its way more intensely into people's consciousness, but even then very, very, very dangerously.
And when we say dangerously, we mean most specifically because it threatened the Christian dogma.
Yeah, first of all, Christianity is a religion that was committed to saving souls. And what saving souls meant for early Christians was to save them from error. If you feel that, if you feel that you have to save people from eating, as they would have called it, poison bread, then you have to actually get rid of the stuff that might poison them. And that meant getting rid of the people who might be carrying the poison. Anyone who embraced this set of beliefs would have been killed in this early period. Indeed, there are some instances of people imprisoned or killed.
And The Swerve, which is the title of the book, refers to the fact that civilization swerved toward what we now regard as the modern by the various merest chance that this poem continued to exist and then would happen to be discovered and then made its subversive way through civilization?
My title, The Swerve, refers to the fact that something happened. This is the actual beating heart, the specific instance of that Renaissance at its most radical, something coming back across the huge gap of time and changing the course of the human spirit, of human thought. But it isn't the only meaning of the swerve, because there are swerves of other kinds. There was the swerve that led to the disappearance of this text. Cultures don't move in one direction. They don't move in predictable directions. It's possible for an entire civilization to give up on its reading, to give up on its books. The libraries were shut down in the 5th and 6th centuries. The schools were shut down. People stopped copying books. Things began to disappear. That's also a swerve.
The Dark Ages.
Yes. And behind that whole set of questions of why cultures move in one direction or another, there's another swerve, which is, that's the term that Lucretius used to describe why anything exists at all, that each atom must have tiny movement. It can be almost indescribably small, a tiny swerve out of the straight line. And all you need, in fact, is a single atom having that swerve out of the straight line, and things begin to bang together and separate. Things begin to create into shapes. Things begin to pull apart. And indeed, for Lucretius, for this whole tradition, that swerve meant the possibility of human freedom.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kurt. It's a pleasure.
Stephen Greenblatt is a professor of humanities at Harvard. His book is called The Swerve, How the World Became Modern, and it's just out. Coming up, sick of all the same chain stores taking over your main streets?
That tree there is a pylon, but some things you can rely on. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be.
It's a song about progress.
The witty and delightful John Wesley Harding is up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
There's a hard luck story everywhere you look, but all the glory. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by PBS, presenting a look at the law that turned America lawless. From Ken Burns, Prohibition, starting Sunday at 8, 7 Central on PBS.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. So there's this guy I know, multi-talented in the extreme. His third novel came out earlier this year, but he always seems to have an album coming out too. He's about to release his 12th.
I might be dead, but I'm still paying tax. I might have had a heart attack. I think I want my money back. I might be dead.
In his spare time, he puts together these smart, fun variety shows with his friends that he calls the Cabinet of Wonders. I'm talking about John Wesley Harding, and he is here with me now, along with his band, The English UK. John Wesley Harding, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
Or should I call you by your non-stage name, Wesley Stace?
Wesley covers both.
Well, we'll get to your multiple identities in a moment. But first, before we talk about anything, will you play a song?
Absolutely.
And what is this going to be?
It's called There's a Starbucks Where the Starbucks Used to Be. It's a song about progress.
There's a freeway where we played football in the fields. Apartments on the pitch at Highbury. There's a shed called Deer Creek, of which my one critique is there's no creek now and it's all deer free. There's a Walgreens where there were no walls, just greenery. There's a theme park in a palace in Tennessee. That tree there is a pylon, but some things you can rely on. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. There's a hard luck story everywhere you look, but oh, the glory. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. There's a stadium where we used to drink at Freddy's, for a team that no one likes or wants or needs. They said they'd revitalize the place. Now there's a million parking spaces, maybe bedrooms for the homeless refugees. There's a chain store where mom and pop once prospered. They're divorced now and they live in penury. Their kids grew up and moved away, but I hear that happens anyway. There's a Starbucks where they live, I guarantee. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. There's a hard luck story everywhere you look, but oh, the glory. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. Yeah, I miss the old Starbucks, but the new one's just the same. It's got coffee, CDs, it's even got the same name. You know, I wouldn't have even noticed, but you hadn't have told me. Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. There's a heart.
luck story everywhere you look, but all the glory is the Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be. There's a Starbucks where the Starbucks used to be.
I love that song. That was John Wesley Harding playing There's a Starbucks. Performing with him were members of what I will choose to call the John Wesley Harding Band, and they are?
The English UK. On guitar, David Nagler. On the bass, Eddie Carlson. And on the drums, Steve Goulding.
It's among other things, I realized listening to that right then, is that song, Your Music, You, are exactly the kind of music that Starbucks sells. And and one could imagine hearing that song were it not for the song in a Starbucks.
It's not really anti-Starbucks, that song. I mean, Starbucks is no different.
They're
to
just
the
a,
Gap
a poster
or
corporation.
Exactly.
Have you heard from them?
No. I've had so little contact with Starbucks recently.
Although it's not anti-Starbucks, it is in a tradition that I realized what it reminded me of is a song that was played in my youth that became big, Joni Mitchell's Big Taxi.
Absolutely.
They paved over paradise and put up a parking lot.
You don't know how right you are.
With a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
So you took as your performing name the name of this obscure American outlaw that Bob Dylan made famous when you were a baby.
Yes.
How come? Just because Wesley is your name and Wesley is in this name?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the important distinction is that John Wesley Harding's the name of the rather evil cowboy. And then
without
the G. Yeah, and then for some reason Dylan added the G, the theory being that he dropped out so many in Blowin' in the Wind and times are changing that he thought he'd add one when he had the opportunity to. I was at Cambridge University, I was doing my PhD. I wasn't really meant to be running around doing gigs. And so I took a fake name, not so they didn't know, but just so that when it all went badly wrong, I could go back to what was likely to be my career path, which would have been in the social and political sciences department. And I got a gig supporting this band, the Hothouse Flowers, which I only got because my friend who was standing next to me said, no, I don't want to, because he'd just done a tour with them. It was a complete disaster and nobody had come. And then they had this massive hit single called Don't Go, and I was their support act. So I was suddenly playing to 500, 1,000 people every night in England for 50 quid. And so I had to think, well, am I going to stick with this silly name or am I not? And the truth of it is, I mean, I can be honest about this. If 23 years ago somebody had said to me, you will still be making music in 25 years' time, would you like to have your real name or this stupid fake name you've got? Then the answer probably my real name. The good news about it is that when I started writing novels, I could use my real name, and that was really handy
right.
for the reception of those novels, I think.
To not be this Madonna writing novels, but
exactly. I mean, I've just seen my friend Josh Ritter come out with a book, a great book, I think, and Steve Earle's book, excellent. And I just don't think these books get the attention they deserve. But having said that, I think it was very nice for reviewers of my first novel to kind of be able to discover for themselves that I was a
Oh, this guy also writes
exactly.
does music.
And that meant that gave him something to write about.
But so you have these two parallel careers, John Wesley Harding, the singer, songwriter, pop rock guy, this, and then writing novels, as Wesley states. Is standing up on a stage and singing different, or is it the same guy?
It's the same guy. We do this show called This Cabinet of Wonders, and at that show, I really feel that's where those things come together, because my writer friends that I like come and read, and the musicians I know and can get to do it come and play, and there's comedy right in the middle, and that's where I feel like it all comes together.
And it is this. I first came to know of you through your Cabinet of Curiosities thing that you do. This is this, on the one hand, funny old-fashioned variety show yeah. of comedians and performers and musicians and shtick, and this very modern thing. Was that just born one day? I should be doing this as an impresario?
So I was thinking of a way, how can I do some shows which aren't just me shows, but I kind of feature all the things I really like? And I mean, it just kicked off, actually. And it's been one of the really fun things of the last 2 years, just like a snowball rolling down a hill. It couldn't be more fun.
Your third novel, Charles Jessel, Considered as a Murderer, came out earlier this year, which is this complicated, lovely murder mystery involved in classical music 100 years ago in England. What made you want to write novels, other than the fact that you were almost a Cambridge PhD 20 years ago?
Well, I think I just got to the point where I just felt that music wasn't using all of my brain. That's the honest truth. I can't really think of another way to slice that question. I just got to the point where I just felt like I'm not communicating all I can communicate to people in these songs. I feel this kind of bursting out of me. I think they're wonderful partners, writing and making music, because music can be very much about instant gratification. I mean, I've written songs, I played them that night. People have applauded. You know, you play with the band, you do a rehearsal, we come and do the show. People will hear it, people will applaud. It's very, writing, as you well know, and as anybody, you know, if anybody has a surfeit of feelings of achievement in their lives, please take up novel writing, because it's very, it will set you back to normal where the rest of us are.
And while you're working on a novel, can you also write songs?
Yeah, I can. And in fact, the next novel's actually, which is really weird because the other ones have been so set in the past, the next one's actually about a band. And so I've, you know, I'm kind of writing their songs, although it's set some time ago.
Really? That sounds like almost these two parts of you are going to meet in some terrible conflagration now.
Yes.
Before you go to do some other thing in the world, write a novel, write more songs, be a variety master. Will you play another song right now?
Yes, I'd love to play
another song. And what will
that be? This is also on The Sound of His Own Voice. And this song is called I Should Have Stopped. And it's a song that is notable for one fact, aside from the fact that I love it, which is that when I played it in the key with the album on the band, who are, I should say, are members of the band The Decemberists, with Peter Buck of recently broken up REM, I just read, and Scott McCoy. When we played it, we did it in a different key to what I was used to. And when it got to the bridge, I realized I couldn't sing the bridge anymore, but I liked it the way it was. So what I did was, it's all about a guy seeing a girl in a laundromat and remembering her from school. And so what I did was I had Laura Veers sing the bridge as though it was actually, you know, Mother is the Necessity of Invention, but she did a dynamite voice. But here, I shall be singing it on my own.
John Wesley Harding, Wesley Stace, both of you, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
I remember you when we were both at school. For one short week, we shared the same carpool. Hey, hey. Oh, then I saw you today. Well, you're looking pretty special in your disco hat as you do your dirty laundry at the laundromat. Life has intervened, but nothing's changed. Your eyes look kind of tired, but you basically look the same, the same. You were never really that good at sports, but you kissed me on a dare behind the tennis courts. Hey, hey. Well, you'd been all the way. And I always was afraid of your fearsome friends. You used to disappear with them for long weekends. Well, one day you left, Monday never came. Oh, there you are standing in the wash and fold again. I should have stopped and said hello.
John Wesley Harding's new album is called The Sound of His Own Voice, and it's out next month. But in the meantime, you can watch a video of him playing a song from the record just for us here at Studio360.org. Last week on the show, we talked about the reboot of DC Comics, Superman, Batman, and the rest. They're reimagining all those superheroes you grew up with. One of the reboots that some people are second-guessing is Wonder Woman, who has now come back fighting evil creatures, more like a character in a horror movie. On our website this week, you can hear the strange story of Wonder Woman and why she still hasn't come to the multiplex near you. That's at our website, studio360.org. Coming up, what was it about Ina Ray Hutton that made her such a star? That blonde hair? That great voice?
All of me. Why not take all of me?
And she had that booty.
Yes, she did. She had the badonkadonk. Not a very scholarly term, but one that I will quote my students as saying.
And that's ahead in a moment in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Your goodbye left me with eyes that cry. How can I go on, dear, without?
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A couple of weeks ago, I threw out a notion into the Twitter and Facebook universes. I realized that aside from The Great Gatsby and a couple of others, I had never read any book more than twice. Or, aside from The Wizard of Oz and a couple of other movies, I'd never seen any movie more than twice. With books, you see, my problem is that I have so many great old books that I haven't read even once, and there's this constant flow of new books I'm dying to read, and I'm a slow reader. So I ended my Facebook post by asking, I wonder how weird this is. Apparently, it's very, very weird, at least to a lot of you. I was inundated by passionate people extolling the virtues of multiple rereadings. So I decided to call up a friend of mine, the writer and English professor Anne Fadiman, to talk this through. Among other things, she's edited a book of essays called Rereadings.
My father, who was a literary critic, once wrote, when you reread a classic, you do not see more in the book than you did before. You see more in you than there was before. You bring a different set of life experiences.
Right.
I remember reading Middlemarch for the first time. I was 18, and I was newly in college, and Dorothea falls in love with a middle-aged a scholar named Kasabin, and I remember thinking, he's a little old for her, but at least he's smart. And I thought that her second husband, who was a studly young guy named Wilk, just wasn't good enough for her. But then I reread the book 2 years later after I discovered sex, and I thought, you know, Wilk looks pretty good now, and Kasabin looks terrible.
But you, as an approach, as a philosophy, believe that it is better to read certain great books a third or fourth or fifth time and pay the price of not reading other works ever, because it's a zero sum game we're here.
It's a zero sum game in terms of the number of volumes that you read, but I'm not sure it's zero sum in terms of how much you get out of them. Do you hear a Beethoven symphony just once and say to yourself, "Okay, I checked that one off my list"?
No, but I'm quite the opposite. In fact, I have my little computer loaded, rotation of music, and I listen to things over and over and over again. But that's
why? What's the difference?
Because
is it that you don't feel anxiety, that music is pure pleasure for you, so you don't have to think, I've already checked off my Beethoven's, I better go on and do the complete works of Vivaldi now? You probably don't think that, because music is pleasurable. You feel guilty because maybe you haven't, eaten all your broccoli.
Yeah,
you haven't read all your Tolstoy's.
Thank you, doctor.
And then another kind of special rereading case is reading books to your children that you read as a child. Have you enjoyed that?
For sure. And I sort of fence off the reading to children or watching movies a million times with children in the age of the video from this. But sure, that is its own special pleasure, no question.
I read my son the entirety of Lord of the Rings when he was about 9.
You're a better parent than I.
And I hadn't read it myself for about 30 years.
Yeah.
And it was amazing how much stuff I'd skimmed when I'd read it myself. Oh, another description of, you know, sort of what the mountains look like. I think I'll go on to the next battle.
Are you Anne Fadiman, intellectual superwoman, giving us and me permission to skim great literature?
Sure. First of all, I'm hardly an intellectual superwoman, but I am Anne Fadiman, and I do give you personally permission, Kurt, to skim great literature.
Huh.
You have to make great literature yours. You're not trying to get an A in your English class, and
yeah.
Neither am I. We are reading for pleasure, so we can read any damn way we please. We can look at the back page and find out what happens at the end. We can make it ours now.
Anne Fadiman, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
The writer and rereader, Anne Fadiman. So we want to know, are you like me and once or twice is enough? Or are you more of an Anne Fadimanian? What book do you love to reread over and over? Or movie do you love to rewatch a million times? Go to studio360.org right now and let us know. And if one of you changes my mind, I'll give you a call and reread whatever you tell me to.
And now the Melody of Swing, a number written especially for our orchestra.
Back in the 1930s, Ina Ray Hutton was known as the blonde bombshell bandleader, strutting her stuff in front of her all-female band called the Melodeers. She continued to lead bands through the 1950s in clubs, in movies, and on television. She was one of the very few women to do so back then. Hutton died in 1984, and KUOW's Phyllis Fletcher has found out that her life was even more interesting than we knew.
Ina Ray Hutton was a stone-cold fox.
It spread like a forest blaze, became a craze, and thanks to Harlem now, everybody's trucking.
Take a look on YouTube at films of her performances from the 1930s. In the comments, people are like,
shake that thing.
She's kind of hot.
Kind of hot? She's smoking.
In the films, she's conducting a band of women musicians in long, flowing dresses, her Melodeers. She's got a baton, but that's not what she's using to conduct. She is shaking that thing. Just ask Tammy Kernodle, a music history professor at Miami University of Ohio.
Ina Ray knew how to cut a rug, boy, you know, which I think is so important in light of what you've discovered about her background.
Here's what I discovered about Ina Ray Hutton. One day I was in the music library at the radio station where I work, with our swing music DJ, Amanda Wild.
Well, you were going to fill in on the show and pick the music yourself, and I wanted to get you acquainted with the library. Well, I do remember pulling out that CD. I thought you would be interested in some female band leaders for the show.
On the back cover, Ina Ray is the blonde bombshell. But on the front,
we have her in the dark hair, a picture you very rarely see, Ina Ray Hutton with the dark hair. And so when you and I were looking at this together, I showed it to you. And I remember you saying something like, I think that chick may be black.
There was something about the shape of her face. She had that big old forehead, big cheeks, round lips. She looked like me. Not that I'm a bombshell. But I have that big old forehead. I have big cheeks and round lips. White people think I'm white all the time. But I'm white and black. So I went looking for Ina Ray Hutton in the Chicago census records, and the answer was there. When she was a girl, she was considered mulatto, or Negro, depending on what year it was. So as an adult, she was passing, letting people think she was white.
My mouth dropped. I mean, I just sat there like, whoa.
Dr. Kernodle had been teaching Ina Ray Hutton in her jazz history classes. She hadn't known. I called Ina's niece, Susan. She lives in Oregon. I asked if she knew about her black family.
And I said no.
Then she thought back to conversations she used to have with her grandma.
I used to always say to my Nana, "How come you have such black hair, Nana?" And she would always say, "Well, that's because I'm half Cherokee Indian."
Nana was Marvel Cowan. She had two kids, June and Odessa, who became Ina Ray.
She did tell us that she grew up in Chicago and they didn't have a lot of money and she was a single mom.
Marvel Cowan played piano in dance halls and hotel ballrooms. The Chicago Defender, the black newspaper, advertised her gigs. And when Odessa was just 7 years old, there she was in the Defender, photographed with two other black girls in their dance costumes. But by 1925, the Defender had stopped writing about them. Odessa was eight, and she had just been discovered by a white vaudeville producer. The producer put together a review once a year to feature talented children. Odessa got in as a tap dancer.
It was probably hard for them back then. So she kind of had the girls construct this life, and it worked for them.
And probably just said, from here on out, this is what you will be.
On the books, Odessa was still Odessa Cowan, a black girl living on the South Side. But in New York City, she was making her Broadway debut as Ina Ray. She was in the Ziegfeld Follies. By 1934, she was 18, and she was the blonde bombshell bandleader. For 5 years, Ina Ray Hutton and her Melodeers toured vaudeville circuits all over the country. They were the first all-girl band to be recorded and filmed.
Tonight we're in Virginia, playing for the officers and men stationed at Fort Monroe, presenting in person and in the spotlight, Ina Ray Hutton.
Reviewers always went on about her face and her body and how she could move it.
Ina Ray as the leader of a white all-girl band had to create a stage performance that catered to white audiences. It's almost a double entendre. It's a play on culture, you know, to have this white woman who's passing. She is embodying all of that physicalness that we equate with African American culture, standing in front of them dancing. It's like a cultural joke to me. And I don't mean joke in a bad way. It's almost like the I got you.
And she had that booty.
Yeah, she did. She had the badunkadunk. Not a very scholarly term, but one that I will quote my students as saying.
I hear Ina cling to her blackness in her music. In fun songs, about a dance that started in Harlem and now everybody's doing it.
Up from Harlem, we bring you the Susie Q.
A new dance hit the town. It started getting round. It's something new I found doing Susie Q. It started like a flame. It's bound to make a name. Come dance your way to fame, doing Susie Q.
People don't really know much about passing now, but when you pass for white,
you're giving up everything. You're giving up that community. You're giving up those systems of support, and you're giving up your family. It's almost as if you have walked away from everything that you've known, and you're starting out in a foreign land where you may speak the same language, but your customs and practices and your way of identifying yourself have been different.
Now I feel like I kind of missed out on the fact that, yeah, I'm part black and I never knew that. And here I am, almost 57 years old, and I feel like I missed out on a lot because of it. I think I could have had more relationships with people of African descent and maybe learned more about it.
Susan now believes her mom and her aunt knew they were passing, even though they were so little when it started. Ina was eight. June was five.
A child like Ina Ray would have spent her whole life being told what she could and could not do as a black young girl.
So I think the indoctrination to pass would have probably been more easy for her than we believe. Odessa had to die so that Ina Ray could live and be born.
When someone would pass, there was always a group of people who knew, or maybe even someone who could just see it. So why did it stay quiet until now? How come nobody called her out?
There was nothing to be gained from that. Plus, there were people who empathized with people who decided to pass, because it was thought that, I mean, you essentially had cut yourself off from the lifeblood of who you were. So, you know, people who passed, that was a very open secret.
For Studio 360, I'm Phyllis Fletcher.
You can see a film of Ina Ray Hutton and her Melodeers at studio360.org. And that's it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening, and maybe for re-listening, too. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Rachel Greenberg,
Emma Miller,
Katie Long,
Sharon Mashihi.
Very special thanks to George Wellington, and as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegen.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360.
It's not as if we should be scared of Big Brother. Big Brother should be scared of all of us. So the fact that citizens are in a better position to watch their government is a good thing.
In the internet age, who's watching whom? The new art and technology of surveillance. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.